It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match.
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. Just me, Simon Hughes. Today, Simon Mann still sunning himself somewhere abroad. Lucky man. Lots of interesting talking points going on in cricket. No actual matches today, but another round of championship matches starting tomorrow, Friday, April the 26th. And today, the chairman and the chief executives of the different county clubs are all meeting up with the ECB to talk about the 100 and private investment and the possibilities and the opportunities for the game to get involved in the private investment world, private equity, etc. It'll be fascinating to see what they decide to do and how the ECB structure that potential opportunity. More about that, I guess, over the coming days. As I say, a series of county championship matches coming up tomorrow. Probably the key championship match of the round is Surrey against Hampshire. It looks like Surrey and Essex are the two teams to beat again this season. I'm sorry Simon's away, actually, because there's a needle game going on in Division 2, Gloucestershire, his club, against Middlesex, my original club. So I'd hope that some Middlesex will get some bragging rights during that match down in Bristol. So today we're going to take a slightly more detached look at the world of cricket with a really esteemed guest, the man who was our guest in the virtual cricket club earlier in the week, David Gower. Of course, the former England great, and just to give you a measure of how great he was, 117 test matches, 8,231 runs, an average in the high 40s, 1800s. And don't forget, also, by the way, people tend to forget, 114 one-day internationals as well. And he made 700s in those with a strike rate of 75. So, of course, he was no slouch. He was an absolutely fantastic, charismatic player. And we're going to talk quite a lot of things. We're going to talk about his post-Sky career, what he's been doing. Actually, he's been writing some quite interesting material for The Cricketer, interviewing a different personality each month. Last month, actually, Piers Morgan and he had lunch together and talked about all sorts of things. We're going to talk about his time in Pakistan as a commentator, both of the test matches that England played out there and also for the PSL, the Pakistan Super League. And we're going to talk about his thoughts on county cricket. Of course, he had a strong connection with Leicestershire originally and then also played for Hampshire as well. And he takes a peripheral interest in county cricket. And later, we're going to hear from some of our virtual cricket club members asking him some key questions about how he gets into the alpha state to be able to play those memorable innings, what his favourite Twitter account is in cricket, how to play fast bowling, his most embarrassing dismissals, and of course also a little bit about his one test wicket and who he'd like to be if he was a modern player. Which player would he most like to be? But first, we thought we'd talk about the subject on everyone's lips, in everyone's heads all the time at the moment, Test cricket. How to save Test cricket, what's going to happen to Test cricket, how will the IPL and other tournaments affect it and inhibit it over time. And I started it by saying to David, is he worried about Test cricket's future?
The most alarming thing to me as a, you know, first of all, as a player who looked at Test cricket as the ultimate, and as actually, to be fair, I mean, I think the great players of this current era, so the Joe Roots of this world, the Virat Kohlis of this world, you look at all the, you know, the current greats, they would still, I'm very sure about this, look at their Test match records as the most important part of their careers. But they'll look at, you know, the many things they do nowadays to boost the bank balance, including IPL and the franchise leagues, as very much part of their career and very much part of, you know, building for their own personal futures. And that's absolutely understandable. The problem is this, isn't it? I mean, the most startling thing to me in the last 12 months is that, give or take 12 months ago, we were talking about, you know, the balance between the best form, i.e. Test cricket, and the franchise leagues and everything else that has to be shoehorned into our cricketing summers, our cricketing years. And the talk was of windows for franchises. And very swiftly, I mean, Manoj Badali wrote a Stone Rolls thing, isn't he? He was changing the entire dynamic by saying, do you know what? We need to start looking for a window for Test cricket. And that's how quickly this world is changing. I went to the Caribbean in December to commentate on white ball cricket. What happened there? Well, for the first three games or so, the West Indies were denuded of their best players, or some of their best players, because they were doing a bank raid in Abu Dhabi playing T10. And when they came back, they slotted back into the side again. That highlights one of the West Indies' great problems as a, you know, former cricketing region with huge history and huge talent, because their talent is, you know, it's bought elsewhere. But the white ball games, so eight white ball games in December for Johnny Grave as CEO, made a profit. The previous year, three test matches, so 15 days potentially of test cricket in the Caribbean, made a loss. And this is the reality that we have to face, that things like that are horribly true. South Africa is sending a C team to New Zealand because everyone else was contracted to the one thing that makes money in South Africa for them, which is the SA20. It just highlights the way it's all changed so very rapidly. And unless, I mean, one of the only things I can see as a bargaining tool is this: if ICC had any balls at all and were able to somehow change their approach to how they distribute the multi-millions, billions that they earn from ICC events, because with India getting, you know, a third of it, I mean, what is the point of that?
It's 240 million. It's crazy. It's massive. Okay. Yeah.
Well, let's just say the word massive. You know, for the country that already has all the money and has the power, if ICC was doing what it's meant to do, which is promote the game across the world, you know, it would be very easy for India to give away some of that income and spread that largesse around the nations that really need it, which includes South Africa, West Indies, you know, New Zealand, you know, places where generating that sort of money is impossible. And of course, you've got the associate nations, you've got, you know, so this broader cricketing world, which, you know, we'd like to promote. We'd like to see the game prosper, you know, wherever there are people keen to play, including Iceland. I mean, I love the Iceland cricket Twitter account, sorry, X account. They are brilliant. I follow them every time. I mean, they come up with some fantastic stuff. They are very much tongue-in-cheek. They've just posted pictures of the Icelandic ashes, you know, the volcanic ashes. So yeah, a replica of the ashes with a bit of lava, volcanic lava underneath it. They posted a picture of their, you know, the recent final of their own little league, which was played under leaden skies in, you know, ski kits and with the background of the, you know, the erupting volcanoes in southern Iceland. So, I mean, they have a few obstacles to overcome as well. But I think, you know, the serious point goes back to redistribution of the many, many multi-funds that are available without giving the lion's share to the people who are already fabulously wealthy.
Yeah, it's 240 million that the Indians get, and compared to that, and Tino Best raised this last week, actually. West Indies get 27 million, so you know, 10 times or a tenth of what Indians get. It's incredible.
Okay, the other figure is IPL's TV rights alone, before you add in anything else, is what, $6.5 billion over 5 years, something
that's
like
right.
that.
It is.
And that's the primary rights. That's not even the streaming rights, which are added on top of that, I think.
No, it's total, actually. It's $3 billion for digital and $3 billion for.
Will you stop?
I've got to get the facts right. You know,
I
know this.
Right,
these facts are embedded in my head, I'm afraid, at the moment.
Yeah.
I don't want you to be accused of inaccuracy.
Good point. I'm a broad brush man. Broad brushes.
So just to kind of finish on that, you know, that would be your sort of initial approach.
Mm.
Right? I mean, the window into Test cricket idea maybe kind of can help, but you think the redistribution is the sort of the number one priority of the ICC?
Well, I think both things are important. I think, you know, we have to accept the reality that, you know, franchise cricket as a sort of generic term and as a thing, as it were, will encroach further and further. We haven't even got to Saudi yet, and Saudi, I know, are planning, to get involved at some stage soon as well. So, I mean, the days left in the year will diminish rapidly. And I think there might have to be an acceptance that, you know, the Test cricket window is possibly a way around this. And that if you can schedule various series at, you know, a suitable time to sort of to keep everyone happy, which of course is the dream for all. Well, you know, that might be in a way, a sad reality. Because I mean, as I say, people like me, my generation, we revere Test cricket and would like to see it, you know, given not just a little bit of space in between other stuff, but, you know, to be given the full respect for what it is. And the difference between, and there's so many analogies we've heard a million times, you know, sort of fast food, real food stuff. You know, the difference between a really tough day of Test cricket, and as you say, you can see an IPL game or an American League game or a PSL game or a 100 game. And it might, you know, it comes down to a biff, bang, bosh for the last, you know, half hour. Someone wins, someone loses, and then you move on, you know, and then that's that. And, you know, I challenge people to remember each and every T20 game they've seen. Actually, to be fair, I challenge them to remember each day's Test cricket they've seen. But there's a greater chance that, you know, the quality of the Test match day will somehow stand up.
Mm. Yeah, it's so hard to write about T20 actually as well. There's nothing to sort of latch onto, really. In fact, a T20 game is like an IPL game is like a Bollywood movie, isn't it? It's just sort of excitement and sadness and happiness and actually kind of not much in between. You spent some time in Pakistan recently, both doing the PSL and also Test matches. So how do you see the Pakistan cricket now, the state of that? We know everything about India. What about Pakistan?
Well, I mean, you can take for granted the immense enthusiasm for cricket in Pakistan. PSL has done a great job of promoting talent in the same way as IPL has promoted a lot of local Indian talent and put it to the forefront, put it in front of the spotlight. PSL has done the same for Pakistan and their emerging talent. They have some very fine players and they have a system that's, yeah, generating interest. I mean, again, you've got the same contrast. Doing PSL, which I haven't done for a couple of years, but doing PSL was great fun. Starting, you know, looking at this bunch of talented players coming through was interesting and fun. Doing the Test matches, I mean, this is the Test matches just over a year ago now were extraordinary because thinking of England and baseball, how would it translate to the subcontinent? Well, the truth is it translated far better in Pakistan than it did in India this last winter, partly because of the difference in the quality of the players and, in fact, the difference in the pitches, because the pitches used in Pakistan, the first two were absolutely flat. The third one in Karachi turned a bit, but England had the advantage and Rehan Ahmed, of course, picked up his 5-wicket haul in the second innings there. But the way England played there was a justification of their entire approach to the game of Test cricket. So it was interesting, it was fascinating, it was entertaining. The games went the distance. You know, imagine, if you remember, the first couple of games, basically the win was forced in the dying moments of the fifth day in both games, with, you know, the light dying as well. I mean, Pakistan is a fascinating place to be. And the, you know, the we also took, apart from doing a bit of commentary out there, which is great fun and very enjoyable and very satisfying, we had a tour group for the company I'm associated with who are Black Opal, and other tour groups came as well. And the group of 13 that we had for Multan and Karachi, and with time spent in Lahore doing the sites in between, had the most fantastic time. Security wasn't an issue. I mean, there was loads of security around, which there had to be. But we had the most fantastic time when we got away from the security in Lahore, away from the cricket. You know, we went everywhere. We did the border crossing, you know, that great theatre that is the border between Pakistan and India. We did all sorts. Jinnah's Tomb. We went to Aitchison College, which, of course, produced the likes of Imran Khan, Azid Khan, you know, various great Pakistani cricketers from that particular school. And the culture is very, very welcoming. So, you know, the those in the stands in the stands at the respective grounds found themselves being welcomed. You know, thank you for coming. Not just our group, of course, all the English tourists who went, I think, were made to feel very, very welcome indeed. And that's what Pakistan just so much craved after, you know, a decade playing in the Middle East, you know, in Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Sharjah, playing in front of home crowds, playing in front of their own people in their own grounds. Was very, very special for them. So there is a strong chance, I think, I'll be back there in October, one way or the other, to have a look at the next three test matches they play as well, and to get, you know, into different places in that quite extraordinary country.
Yeah, I mean, I toured there actually once as well, and I really liked it. I agree with you, actually. We went to some really interesting places. We went to a tribal village, which you had to sign a chit to go to and sort of go through a checkpoint. And the only thing it sold in the entire small town, in every shop, was guns. I don't know if you ever came across anywhere like that. Literally, every shop had guns. Yeah. Where you'd normally see packets of flour and sugar and, you know, various other household items behind a cabinet, it was just lots of guns. And you could sort of choose one and say, can I have a go with that? And then go to the roof of the shop and fire it into the mountains. True story. But I mean, there were so many kind of amazing experiences you can have in Pakistan. So that's a nice thing to look forward to. And and just finally, I mean, away from Pakistan, your other sort of original home, Leicester, where are we looking at with Leicestershire, do you think? I feel there's a nucleus of possibility there with a sort of connection with the South Asian community in Leicester. But at the moment, it's still struggling, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it's been a long time since I played there. I lived in Hampshire for the last 30 odd years. I'm actually due back at Grace Road for an event in sometime in the coming month, actually, in 2 or 3 weeks' time. And it'll be interesting to see how it feels, how it looks. I don't think it's cricket on that particular day, but I mean, Leicester, even back in the 80s, was it was a tight run ship. You know, there was no money or very little money there. And it's still got that feel, hasn't it? I mean, without being at all rude about my former county, where in a sense it's a stepping stone. I mean, there's some very good players there still. I mean, I watched, for instance, the One Day Cup last year, the final between Leicester and Hampshire. I had a good each way bet, my two counties in opposition. And I remember, you know, so the climax of that game was just extraordinary. It's just you know, the way Leicester somehow managed to find a way of winning that game. And it's like when you've, in terms of, say, football teams you support. I mean, I go back to my days living in Leicestershire, living in Loughborough first, when we first went up to that part of the world, and going to Nottingham Forest, going to Leicester City, going to Leicester Tigers to watch the rugby, going to Trent Bridge to watch the cricket, we're going to Grace Road to watch the cricket. And you have that sort of thing where you keep those links without, in my case, necessarily following it exhaustively. But you have that sort of same ties, those same little bonds that never go. So I sort of keep a passing eye on Leicester. And it's nice to see when they have a good day or a good game. But I can imagine it's a financial struggle still. I can imagine, you know, the sort of frustration of seeing good players move on to bigger clubs. But at the same time, this is, in a sense, a good reason to keep county cricket as it is, because it gives people these opportunities. Okay, even if you have to accept, in the same way as we have to accept that, you know, Test cricket is battling against 20-over cricket, franchise cricket, you have to accept, if you're Leicestershire, that, you know, some people will learn their trade with you and will play well for you, and they might well be persuaded, say, to go to Trent Bridge a couple of seasons later or three or four seasons later to try and, you know, it's sort of the Dick Whittington stuff. You know, the streets are paved with gold 30 miles up, you know, further north, maybe. An opportunity maybe lies there. So, again, it's an acceptance of reality, I think. But I think, yes, I think there is absolute value in keeping counties solvent. And that's, you know, that's, again, a very current thing, is it not? That, you know, some of these counties are so dependent on the central monies again. You know, obviously, the great thing at the moment is this, you know, this building towards private equity coming into the game. Exactly how it happens is still being debated, of course. I actually quite like, I think, what I saw, which is the, you know, the Richard Thompson, Richard Gould ECB model, which is dividing, you know, making sure, obviously, that anyone getting the private equity directly, fine, the big clubs will get that, but that making absolutely sure that the clubs not directly involved will still get a proper share of whatever revenue is coming in, because that keeps the game together. And again, there is going to be, at some stage, I guess, an acceptance that what is new might not appeal to everyone, but it is the way the game will survive.
Do you ever get canvassed for your views on this?
No. No, honest, simple answer, no. There is, Mark Nicholas has got this day coming up, hasn't he? I think in, it is now, June, July, which is sort of a world conference. You know, so people from all over the world will come to Lourdes under the MCC aegis and discuss some of the things we're talking about now. You know, all these things, all these many, many important issues that will affect the game at large in the future. And although he was trying, I think, to get, shall we say, the more current people, you know, so the, you know, the chairman of various boards, the CEOs, you know, so the people who are the genuine movers and shakers now, I actually had to email him and say, do you mind if I come? So I have my invite.
Good, actually, because you need some bloody players on it, don't you? I mean, it's all very well having the CEOs, but you should have some proper players on it as well.
Well, there will be. I'm sure there will be. I mean, again, I don't know the entire guest list. It's not my party, but there will be representatives of the administration, of the playing department. I think every aspect of the game, I would assume, will be represented. So it could be very interesting. It could be fascinating to see what comes of it.
One more question from me. If you could be a modern player, who would you like to be?
Good grief. I'd quite like to be Ben Stokes, I think, for the simple reason that, with a good knee, with two working knees. I'm a huge admirer of what Ben's done the last couple of years. Just, you know, sort of the transformation of his own persona, the qualities he's shown as a leader. And of course, you know, when he's on song as a player, it's awesome. So it'll be a complete change of character, a complete change of style. But if you're going to have to reinvent, you know, why be the same again? Come out as something completely different.
You'd have to get a few tattoos as well.
A couple of transfers, maybe just a temporary one, you know, a bit of henna or something, you know.
You'd have to get pretty good at that switch hit as well, I reckon.
Well, I mean, this is the point, isn't it?
You know, you're right-handed naturally, aren't you? So it should be all right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, come on, it's just a couple of seconds. You know, I learned the reverse sweep off Paul Nixon in the Caribbean in the World Cup 3,000 years ago, 80, when 2000, whatever, years ago. Practiced that in the back garden. It's just a couple of minutes' work, we'd be there.
Well, I tried to find a picture of David Gower playing a reverse sweep, but none was to be found. And the idea of David Gower with a tattoo is just horrific, really, isn't it? Anyway, more from Gower after the break, when he'll be answering the questions of some of our virtual cricket club, talking about how he plays fast bowling, what his most embarrassing dismissals were, and also who was his one victim in Test cricket.
Hmm. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Okay, more from David Gower. Now being quizzed by some members of our virtual cricket club. If you want to join our virtual cricket club, by the way, go to worldsbestcc.com and you can sign up. We raise money for the Professional Cricketers Trust, the charity that supports a lot of cricketers who've fallen on hard times. And we have a live interview or a quiz or something like that, a live event every week, usually on a Tuesday or Wednesday night. It's £6 a month to join, but for that, you get live entertainment and also a donation to the Professional Cricketers Trust. So go to worldsbestcc.com to sign up and look up what it's all about. We also have a very active WhatsApp group, by the way, that reports on cricketing events and issues all over the world. It's very lively and interesting, actually. And the man who drives this club now is very much its prime mover, is Rob Whitehouse. And so the first question to Gower comes from him.
David, good evening. Thank you for joining us. You've been an absolute pleasure. If you could go back and replay any match in your career and change the result, what would it be and why?
there are some things, a little bit like drama on TV, some things are just too ridiculous to even contemplate. I'd love to have beaten the West Indies. My worst ever year was trying to captain England in 1989 in the Ashes, where, if I can put it simply, everything that could go wrong did go wrong, some of which I take responsibility for, some of which, without going into it in huge depth, was circumstances beyond my control. If I had to pick one game, we'd lost far too quickly in that series. I had to pick one game to change the result. The first match, which was Headingley, where on day five, we had to basically bat for, I don't know, three quarters of the day just to try and get a draw and failed on a pitch that started to go low. Alderman was just bowling straight, that sort of stuff. If we could have drawn that, that could have changed the approach to the rest of the series. Because you know how important it can be, even in a six-match series, to get off to a good start. Obviously, it makes more of a difference in the shorter series, two, three matches series, which you see nowadays. But even in that series, had we got away with, got away with the draw, even should we say a draw where we could have come second, as it were, the worst of it, that could have changed the dynamic for that summer. That's my random answer to a random question.
Evening, Sam.
Evening, thank you. I usually ask this question, a lecturer at university, I like to hear the answers to this. Mm-hmm. What is your process, and you can still answer this now for your day-to-day, in the micro, so in the moment, and then macro maybe just in general life, when things aren't going right, and talk about it from a cricket point of view, that's why we're here if you want. What are your processes, particularly more cognitive processes, thought processes to pull you and whoever else you might need to, if it's a team sense, out of where you are?
So the two aspects are, let's stick to cricket in a sense. My private life's far too complicated. Let's stick to cricket. If you've had a bad day, one of the great things about cricket and the fact you're playing as part of a team is that you have, give or take, 10 other blokes to help you get over it. And for a lot of, and there's always a truism, which is you'll have more bad days than good over a career, for sure. So you always treasure the good ones and you try and keep those good runs of form going. But when you're having a shocker, I mean, and in fact, my second or third season at Hampshire started. So this is post Australia 1991, with determination, absolutely spot on. But for some reason, everything stopped working. And I tried my best just to process that individually. I remember going home to my future wife, thinking I don't know what to tell her. This is all going horribly wrong. And I firmly believe that actually cricket in those days didn't have real access to sports psychology. It didn't have access to the help that sometimes people, even, shall we say, people like me, needed. There are people like Botham who would never admit it. Complete reset button every day. He would never admit to any human frailty or mental weakness. It lingers within even the best. So I'm a believer that you get the support from your initially from your team members, and if you need it from professionals. And if you look at, say, tennis, golf, Formula One, all the major sports in the world, all the global sports have all these aspects covered. But yes, it can be very, very dark. Let's face it. There are people, and this game tragically has an unfortunately long list of suicides over the last 150 years. But there are some very dark times, even for the best. And you have to somehow, they will always say to you, right, remember, you walk out the following day, you've got to go and bat the following day. Try and focus on the good. Try and remember how it worked. And that sometimes at your lowest ebb can be almost impossible. And all you have to think about is you come through it. You've got to believe you will come through it at some stage. So if you have a bad trot for a couple of weeks, that's doable. If a bad trot goes on for a month, it starts to ebb into your soul. It starts to sort of seep into everything that is important to you. You always come out of it at the end. And I think that's the one thing to cling to. So in essence, you have to believe in yourself and also not to be frightened to open yourself up to others. And that applies, that is a sort of life lesson as well. I think, I hope that sort of kind of encapsulates it.
That's great. No, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Did you have any, cues yourself? That is Q-C-U-E-S, to get yourself out of a low period?
Not necessarily. I mean, the psychologists will tell you can have your affirmations. You can stick a tape on, it's old fashioned. You can stick some sort of audio on with affirmations and stick them into your brain and see if that works. But actually, truth is, even if you do that and you're having a bad run, you're walking out to bat and you're thinking, I'm not sure about this. I'm not exactly chock full of confidence today. And you have that sort of, you grasp onto the thread of hope, which is that you'll see the first one, get into some sort of rhythm quickly, hang around for 20 minutes, start to feel better, hang around for another 20 minutes, start to remember how it works. And then if you're still there at lunchtime, whatever it might be, you could be back on track. But I remember for someone in my case who was so very largely, shall we say, instinctive, compare me, say, to a Geoffrey Boycott. Geoffrey could dismantle himself like a Meccano kit. So if there was a problem, I guess, with Geoffrey, he would go into a net and he would know which part of the mechanics he was trying to fix. In my case, I would find that very hard because I wasn't always quite aware of what the mechanics were. You look at elbows and arms and legs and feet and heads and stuff. You can tinker. But actually, it was more of the feel of things has to be right, which means that when you get out there, your rhythm is right. I talk about rhythm a lot when it comes to batting. You can watch people like, say, Joe Root. To him, rhythm is everything. The trigger movement, the next movement, if it's in sync, it works. If you're a millisecond out, then things can start to go wrong. If you're worse than that, then it's already gone badly wrong. So a lot of it is almost an instant response to what you see. And of course, what you've done as a batsman over the years from, say, youth to schoolboy to second team to county to test cricket is you've just trained your instinct so that you're no longer thinking, you're not reacting consciously to what you see. You're doing it all by instinct because as soon as you have to think about it and you've only got 0.4 of a second, you start to think you've lost most of that 0.4 of a second and you're already coming second. The stump's already flying or the edge has been found or you're, whatever it might be. So instinct is key.
And I suppose, just to finish this, I suppose you would probably say your best innings may have been where your head was completely clear and you weren't thinking about anything. Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. There are times, for instance, I would sort of lie down in the dressing room, having had a quiet look at things going on beforehand, lie down, close your eyes, not go completely to sleep. I think it's something called an alpha state, which is that thing where you can still hear, you've closed your eyes and you are half asleep, as it were. But you can wake from that very quickly, and you can walk out and you have no preconceptions. And so you look around, you assess, you walk out at, say, the Oval with 40 minutes to go to the end of the day, as I did in 1990, and it just slots into place. And you think that, that's actually a very good way, in a way, of doing it, because I think a lot of people get very nervous because they're watching what's going on. And it's, it puts sort of ideas into your head, and they're not always the right ideas. So clearing the mind is indeed the best place. I mean, golfers will talk about that. If you talk to the great golfers, the great tennis players, they're not worried. They're not thinking at the time, they're about to win Wimbledon or the Masters. They're just doing. And that's, that is the ultimate state to be in.
The question I've got is a bit long-winded, but hopefully it makes sense. I want to give you a couple of scenarios. So imagine you're now England Test captain. You're at the peak of your career, but it's 2024. You're playing in a first division team like Hampshire, for example, and you're offered the chance to go and play IPL for, say, Rajasthan Royals. Do you stay in England in April and May, play red ball cricket for your county and prepare for the Test match? Or do you head over to India, play for the Rajasthan Royals for a few months and pop back a week before the Test series starts as England captain? So what's your choice?
Good question. Yes, that tests one's morals to the absolute limit, doesn't it?
That's why I set it that way.
I think, I would actually happily take the example of Mr. Stokes, Ben Stokes currently, who, as captain of England, knows where his bread is buttered. And knows where his responsibility lies. And I respect him actually so much. I mean, I would never have believed, say, 10 years ago that Ben Stokes could be the captain that he obviously is. Mm. And he's, it's an extraordinary thing that he's done and an extraordinary transformation in his own character, I think, or not his career, but his own sort of personality. And I think, his example is the right one, which is if you're captaining England, then that's your first responsibility. Because if I was, say, 30 years old and captaining England now, I would say to myself, well, okay, that is the thing to do. That's the thing to focus on. That's important. And, if the opportunity to bank a million comes up, well, let's not leave it too late. But, there is time maybe to go back and apply to see if you can make the draft for IPL. I mean, I don't quite have the muscle power of Stokes or some of the current IPL stars. Maybe there was enough talent to maneuver the ball around and be part of it. But a bit like Joe Root. I mean, Joe has been picked up a couple of times and has spent 6 weeks basically, doing the Times crossword. I'd do that happily for £1 million, I can tell you. I think the answer is, if you're England captain, that's your responsibility, yeah.
Thank you so much, David, for being here. It's fantastic, it really is. I just want to mention Leicestershire and Jonathan Agnew that they've come up just before. I read an interview, or perhaps it was just he was talking, I can't remember, but Jonathan Agnew said that despite the fact that you played in the Leicester team together quite a bit, he only really batted with you like at the other end once or twice or so, and he, probably because he was number 11 and you were obviously where you were, and he marvelled at the amount of time that you seem to have to be able to see the ball as a proper batsman, unlike him, obviously. Now, here's the thing. In 1984, when I was 16, I saw, which I still maintain to this day, is the fastest ball I've ever seen, which was Malcolm Marshall bowling to you as part of that unfortunate blackwash test series. But he bowled you a ball that was just outside your off stump. It hit the chalk mark, sort of the white puff, and Geoffrey Dujon, I think it was, he was about 30 yards back, took it, for all intents and purposes, looked to me like a half volley. The ball was that quick that you couldn't even on TV with the foreshortening really see it. It looked like a tenth of a second. And I just wanted to ask you this. What on earth is going through how do you know when a ball, it must have been, in all intents and purposes, almost invisible. How did you know where it was going? How long before Malcolm Marshall released that ball are you thinking, oh, I can see what he's about to do, it's going to be full, it's going to be outside off stump?
Obviously, the thing you shouldn't do is preempt. So even if you think you've got an idea what someone like Mako might be doing. I mean, I remember once at Old Trafford, I watched the ball in his hand as he ran up, and it was held very much to be straight or in swinging, and it went the other way, and I ended up nicking it slip. And so, you know, your preemption is obviously the wrong thing. Going back to what I was saying just now, your instinct is what you rely on. So when you watch the hand properly, this is the difference between Aggers and I, you have a clue about from the moment of release. On a good day, you're watching that hand, and the release point is there, wherever it might be. So, you know, full, not so full, short. And that's your first clue. And again, because it's a little bit like, I mean, so learning how to do it is a little bit like learning to drive, is the other analogy. Because when you first learn to drive a car, 30 miles an hour can seem frighteningly quick until you get the hang of it. And as a, you know, a boy of 17, 18, you think, well, that's ridiculous. It's far too boring. You go to 50, then you get the hang of that. 2 seconds later, then you go to 70, then you're bored again. And it depends how good you are as to whether you can manage to control things at sort of 70, 80, 90. And it's the same with the cricket ball coming towards you. When I was, say, 15, some of the club sides we played at school would have bowlers who seemed frighteningly quick. At 16, the same bloke comes back again, still the same pace, and suddenly it seems more manageable. At 17, he now seems medium pace. And then, of course, you move on to county cricket and the whole dynamic changes again. So all these things are part of the training of the instinct. And it's kind of hang around long enough to see it in that instant, that split second. So if you've got to make the assessment in about 0.2 of a second, it's there in 0.4 of a second. And let's face it, I mean, I remember actually, just as an aside, Malcolm bowled me probably the quickest spell of all time, sustained for about 3 or 4 overs at Grace Road one year in the game between Leicester and the West Indies. And for some reason, I was in at number 3 very early. And I got Malcolm all to myself, which I didn't want in the midst of everything else. But he bowled the speed of light, but everything went either sort of past the ribs that side or past the ribs that side. And by adopting a side-on profile, in those days slightly slimmer, you know, I was able to avoid any trouble. And then he suddenly took his sweater, gave up, and his next spell was much more manageable. So, but when they're really coming at you, I mean, there is adrenaline pumping, which also helps with the speed of the muscle reaction. And there's just instinct. You know, they always say, as long as you're still looking at it, you've still got half a chance. And there's Malcolm Marshall at the Oval, 1984. I've got the picture. Patrick Eager took the picture. I'm sort of 2 feet off the ground. The ball goes past the head here somewhere. There's Dujon already looking to go up there with the gloves. Clive Lloyd also looking at it from about 30 yards behind. And it was missed by 2 inches. You know, gloves are out the way, luckily. Head's out the way, luckily, but you sort of tilt the head quickly. Even Yoz will tell you that it's possible, yeah, when your life is threatened, to react incredibly quickly.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, David. Thank you so much.
You weren't a great mover, actually, were you, before the bowler bowled? I mean, it's similar to someone like Sobers. You were quite still, actually, whereas you see the dramatic movement of batsmen nowadays.
Yeah, you can actually tell the difference. I could tell, if I looked at myself, as a commentator on myself, I would tell you when I was nervous because those movements get exaggerated. And sometimes you get yourself in the wrong position with too much of a trigger. So you back and across goes too far back and across. And you know, LBW becomes the obvious result. And then when you settle, then the movements become more instinctive and, you know, less labored. So that, I mean, then you can see that you're, you know, I could look at myself and say, no, I'm settling here. He's now settled in because it's just a bit of a gentle shuffle and a little gentle trigger and everything else flows naturally. So, I mean, I could see that in myself.
I know what Richard was getting at there with that question, because I remember once batting with Dean Jones at Durham against Northants, and Curtly Ambrose hated Dean Jones for various reasons. And there was a real kind of animosity between them. And so this particular spell, Ambrose bowled rapid. And, you know, Jones would get up on his back foot and hit a ball just short of a length, rising. beautifully over the top down to backward point for a single because they'd set the field back so they could bowl at me. Thanks very much. And then I get the same ball and be kind of, you know, fending it off or ducking before I'd seen let go of it or something. And the same ball I was just unable to deal with, and he was hitting it for one with time to spare. So I suppose, you know, there is a sort of a certain level of ability that people are born with or not.
Yes, I mean, you can get so far with practice. One of the great examples from my time was Jack Russell, who, when he first played international cricket, test cricket, looked very vulnerable to the short pitch ball. And he worked his socks off. And we had sort of, the coaches, the various people with actually just interesting technique with soft balls first, just banged in short, so that he developed a technique which allowed him to deal with the short ball. I mean, Snert's not a big lad. He's not a tall lad. But he then became very capable, you know, in the heat of a test match at dealing with what had been a big problem beforehand. So you can learn a certain amount by exhaustive practice. So you can get better. For some people, though, sort of the mental side of that is just impossible. So, you know, there are some people who are destined to be number 11 for their entire lives, and that's that. But others can progress from 9 to 8 to 7 and become, you know, useful players, even when the heat is really turned up.
Evening, David. Thanks so much for joining us and giving us your time. I'll keep it quick. There's been a few sort of detailed, very technical answers. I'll make it slightly shorter if I may. I was once dismissed watching a ball going for six and standing on my own stumps, and it was adjudged that I'd stood on my stumps before the ball crossed the line. How that was adjudged, I don't know.
Right.
What is the oddest way you've ever got out, or ever? What is the strangest sort of dismissal you've seen or been part of?
Well, I mean, I was run out once in Barbados when I was convinced, this has echoes of last summer actually, but I was convinced that the umpire had walked from his position at the bowler's end, was heading towards square leg, so he must have called over. So I was doing a bit of gentle gardening and someone threw the ball to the keeper who took the bails off. Umpire, you know, turned from his little stroll towards square leg, looked up, gave me out, and that was that. You know, there was no recourse to a higher power. So that was a bit disappointing. I did once tread on my stumps defending Devon Malcolm at Chesterfield, and I'd got right, I'd obviously gone just that couple of inches too far back, played it beautifully, played it down nicely in front of me, but, you know, looked behind me, bales on the ground, so I had to trudge off. Where else? I mean, the worst one was the infamous innings I played at Adelaide after the Tiger Moth episode, where for an hour before lunch on day two, I was completely out of sorts and chipped this thing to Merv Hughes at deep square leg, the last ball before lunch. I mean, it's the shortest boundary in world cricket. It only got halfway. Merv just strolled in gently, took the easiest, loopiest catch of all time. And I had Graham as my captain, Graham Gooch as my captain, trudging off behind me. I could still feel his eyes burning into the back of me. And it was, yeah, singularly and simply one of the worst shots of all time, born of just not being in the right place at the right time, as it were. So, I mean, if I were to go back over whatever it was, 18 years of this, I could probably find a few more strange ones. But those are the ones that spring to mind initial questioning, my lord.
Sam has asked, can we ask you about your one test wicket? Talk us through it.
Deeply embarrassing. End of the series in India. You know, dead game in Kanpur, last few overs. I'd been bowling lobs at, first of all, Kiri Kamani, who's a man of short stature who was having a bit of problem with these things, and a fellow called Kapil Dev, who was completely unflustered. Kapil already got 120 or something, and he tried to take this thing from Kanpur to Delhi, I think, in one hit. Slightly miscued it. I think it was Graham Dill had to catch it. And Graham, bless him, Dill had been bowling on this flattest of flat pitches for, you know, 4 days non-stop. Barely got it above stump high. This idiot of a captain throws one, you know, 10 feet in the air, dropping on the stumps. And he had to make that sort of deep moral decision whether or not to pretend he hadn't seen it and just drop it or dive the wrong way or just take the catch. And I'm very glad it's in the book because it makes a very nice statistic, you know, test average of 20, I think. I had a chat, I was comparing a thing, a chat with Stuart Broad and Ian Bell the other day. And we I did a bit of sort of top trump stuff. So I think, okay, right, test bowling average. And, you know, it's one of the few things I could win on. So it's in the book anyway. I'm slightly ashamed of it. It would now be illegal. It would now be a no ball or something, as the, you know, the Spetty used dropper or the lob. Anyway, it's there. It's in the book. It's legal. It was then. And no one can take it away.
They can't. That is very true. It's funny, actually, how often it is that the great test batsman's favourite moments in the game are so often their one or two test wickets achieved in bizarre circumstances. Anyway, thank you very much to David Gower for his excellent contribution there and lingering back into his past and explaining actually how he was such a brilliant player. He was compelling and absolutely mesmerising to watch. And I'll tell you what, horrible to bowl at. I bowled at him quite a bit actually, and I could never get my length right. If I was just fractionally short, he pulled me for four. And then of course I overcompensated and he drove me for four. So very, very difficult bloke to bowl at. And he made it look so easy. He always had so much time that it made you think you were just a powder puff medium pacer, which I suppose I probably was, really. Anyway, the next guest in our World's Best Cricket Club is Darrell Mitchell, the former Worcestershire player, now chairman of the PCA, and he's on next week. So look out for that. Worldsbestcc.com if you want to join us on Zoom and ask him a question and join in our general conversation. And I should also just mention our sister podcast, which I do every week, but they're doing some great stuff at the moment. Storylines with Melissa Story and Nikki Chowdhury. This week's episode is all about Project Darwin and the ECB plan to revitalise women's county cricket with the eight counties now announced as Tier 1 county women's teams. There's a really good debate about the pros and cons of Project Darwin on that latest episode of Storylines. So check it out. Simon and I will be back after the next round of county championship matches next week. In the meantime, enjoy cricket wherever you're watching it or listening to it, and I hope you keep warm because it's not exactly coming into summer weather, is it? But stick at it, and maybe summer weather will be around the corner, and we'll speak to you next week. Thanks for listening.
Podcast Network.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.